Thank you. All right, welcome everybody. This is the American Rescue Plan Act Special Committee meeting. It is June 1st. It's 5:02 p.m. Welcome everybody. If you could call the roll, Clerk Feaster, that would be great.
Criswell.
Here.
Corcoran.
Here.
Levine.
Here.
Lopez.
Here.
Sperry.
Here.
Great, all here and accounted for. Thank you. We have a few legislators who need to jump at some point tonight to go to another function, so I am going to keep us rolling along as quickly as possible. We want to keep space for full, rich conversations, but we also want to keep the conversation moving. So if I feel like we're dragging, I'm gonna roll us along a little bit faster. Is that all right with everybody? Okay, great. So I would like to have a motion to approve the minutes and transcripts of the April 27th regular meeting and the May 11th, 2022 regular meeting. If I could have that motion.
Motion.
And a second.
Second.
Great. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Great. Minutes are approved. All right, I want to draw your attention to the ARPA projects and expenditure document that Amber sent out earlier. It's an update. I've been asking her to update this every time after session, if anything ARPA related has moved forward, which we did have one project move forward. So you can see now the percentages of allocations. And I really love this document. It's really, really helpful to see the pie chart of what we're spending and what we have left. And it looks like at this point, we have about 9.5 million left. Again, that is probably going to change a little bit as some of these projects articulate themselves. And there's a little bit of savings on one project. I don't think we're going to go over on anything, but there might be a few dollars that shake out from some other projects. So that may bump up a bit, but it's only 9.5 million at this point. So again, we have to really think really clearly about where our spending is going to go. Legislators, committee members, did you all have a chance to take a look at this? Did you have any questions or any comments on this document? Okay, great. Seeing none, I would like to go right into the resolutions. So I am gonna, is Legislator Stewart here? I don't see Legislator Stewart. So he is going to, Legislator Stewart is gonna present resolution 289. So I think for the moment, if you don't mind, we'll skip that and we'll see. Amber, do you know, is Legislator Stewart expected to join us tonight?
I'm not sure, but I can confirm while we're moving on.
That'd be great. So let's move on to resolution 290, which is the mental health in schools program. And I believe that the Commissioner of Mental Health, Tara McDonald, is going to be presenting on that. Commissioner, are you used to it now? You're used to it now, right?
I'm used to it now, yes.
That's great.
Used to it now.
Thank you. If you could just give us a little bit of a background on this resolution and then dive into any details that you think are pertinent. And then I want to open up the floor to committee members to ask you questions. Then I'll open up the floor in general to anybody, other legislators, and then anybody else who's on the line who would like to ask a question, if that's all right with you.
That is great with me. I think we actually have a PowerPoint presentation that will help me to run through the information in enough detail, but not blather on too long.
Perfect. Amber, if you could allow Tara to share screen, that'd be great.
So Joanne, I think, is going to.
Okay, great.
Yeah, if you give me access, I can just click for Tara. Thank
Perfect.
You should have access.
Okay. So I do share. Okay. Can you see it?
Not yet. It's coming on though.
All right, awesome.
We got it.
Okay, and before I begin, first of all, I wanna thank you all for allowing for us to be able to speak to this resolution. We really do believe that this is a program that has the potential to help many, many Ulster County students. I just wanted to also let you know that I have joining me today Thomasine Olafat, who is our Children's SPOA coordinator, SPOA standing for Single Point of Access, and she can speak to some of the processes that we have in linking kids to services and how we would be connecting this program to those processes, and also what we've been seeing in terms of the needs for our young people in Ulster County. So you can, thank you so much. So here on this slide, it just sort of gives you a really brief introduction to what it is that we're talking about. And it's the mental health supports for youth that are needed even more now than ever. And I know every generation sort of says, oh, I've never seen it this bad. I've never seen our kids in such distress. But certainly after 2.5 years of the pandemic, I think that we actually are at a place where the level of distress that every young person is experiencing because of not just the pandemic itself or loss of family members due to COVID, but also the ongoing effects and impacts that the pandemic has had on their lives for a number of reasons, for students in particular, not to mention the fact that they've been doing school for virtually for the last 2 years and what it has meant to them in terms of their education. A few of the headlines here that speak to the crisis with regards to depression and self-harm and suicide. And if you look on the bottom left there, it also talks to young people that may be struggling with suicidal thoughts and seeking supports, but the system is overwrought and it's hard for them to access services. And up on the right, I'm almost done, Joanna, sorry. I think that it's particular to point out that though we have a system of behavioral health supports and services and have for many years, regular physical health services and primary care providers are also reporting an increase in the needs of their patients that they're seeing that have behavioral health challenges. And that makes sense, right? So you may not necessarily make an appointment to see your therapist, but if your child is having an issue, the first thing that comes to your mind is to bring them to their doctor, that pediatrician that has been, helping them with runny noses and scraped knees for all of their life. Well, these pediatricians are reporting that our kids are really struggling right now with behavioral health issues. And so the majority, if you can see, the majority of these headlines are really around national data. But unfortunately for us here in Ulster County, this hasn't escaped us. And so that's why I asked if Thomasine can speak to just specifically what we're seeing in Ulster County with regards to applications and outreaches for connections from providers, from families, from parents, from doctors that are looking to be able to make not just clinical connections, but some sort of lifeline support for these kids that are struggling. And Thomasine, if you can speak to this.
Sure. Thank you so much, Tara. So Tara is exactly right. We've seen an increase in the number of SPOA applications. We're getting them from multiple school districts. Many schools are saying, students are just struggling with getting to school. As I have here, increasing the number of youth struggling with anxiety to go to school, the truancy, and the school doesn't have the capacity. They can't go out and get those students to come out of bed to get to school and work with the family at that point. So that's why they make those referrals to SPOA to see what services can we put in place to help work with the family and work with the youth to help them get to school. What is going on with them? How can we support their mental health needs? And because of the pandemic, we're also seeing an increase in the youth struggling with the school transitions. All the youth had to transition from being in person to going remote and then coming back in person as well. This is also, a heightened level of just some transitioning, from, elementary to middle school and middle school to junior high. The transition for them, even just going to the next school has also been a huge, huge issue that has been identified. So we're just seeing an influx of, different needs of students, facing depression, anxiety, as Tara mentioned, suicidal ideation, and really doing what we can to connect them to services. And in conversations with the social work teams at the schools, you know, they're doing the best they can. Last week I was at Ellenville High School doing the health fair, providing resources to the students. Social workers were coming up to me, thanking me so much just from being there to provide information, resources. One student came up to me and said, I was with my social worker for five periods. So five periods, one kid, you know, with that social worker, they're tied up. They're not able to serve other students. So we're just thinking about, you know, it just really gave me that perspective that these, you know, the school social work team, they're doing what we can. And even the students said, you know, I have the support here, you know, but when I go home, I don't have as much support. And how do we continue to bridge those services? So it's just even just hearing from the youth themselves of identifying, like, you know, what they're feeling, the needs are that they needed that continued additional support because of the struggles that they're experiencing. That is what we're hearing.
I will say one last thing in terms of the SPOA. One of the reasons that we look to the school to see if we can make that connection in expanding the level of supports is that SPOA traditionally is for youth that have some level of a previous diagnosis. In fact, in order for us to make linkages for them, they have to have a diagnosis from a licensed professional of the healing arts in order to make those connections. When we're talking about mental health in schools, kids don't necessarily need to know already that they're diagnosed with depression or they're diagnosed with anxiety. They don't even have to have a diagnosis. They just need to be presenting with the challenges that say we need a little bit more support. So I did want to make that distinction as to why we wouldn't just put more resources into our SPOA, because these are kids that have been assessed. We know what, you know, their struggles are, and we have the ability to reach them there. But for the school, we don't want them to have any hoops. Just get the support, no hoops.
Right.
Thanks, Thomas. Exactly. So just around the planning and design of the process, and I'm sorry, I know that these slides are pretty dense. I'm going to try and hit the highlights on them. In spring of 2021, our county exec began to engage the Department of Mental Health in conversations to develop planning to support our local school districts. Between the department and the county exec's office, we initiated conversations with Dr. Corey at BOCES. BOCES has that oversight responsibility for all of the school districts, so we thought that that would be a good place to target some of these conversations. And in consultation regarding the resources and what we could bring to bear, and Dr. Corey said, absolutely, this is what we're responsible for, but you would do better speaking directly to the school districts, which is what we did. We had meetings with the people personnel staff from all of the districts to focus on exploring how the county can support their plans. Those conversations continue to this day. Every once a month, our deputy commissioner is speaking with the pupil personnel staff. At the larger meeting, and we decided that beyond the pupil personnel staff, we would engage the school districts in a larger forum to sort of talk about what we can do in meeting with them district by district, because every district comes with their own personality. Every part of our county may have different challenges and barriers. So we thought it was really important for us to get those individual conversations going. And so we had more in-depth meetings that yielded the need to provide support, but not necessarily clinically in nature, which also speaks to the SPOA piece. So, you know, because the kids that come through SPOA already have diagnoses, and we tend to focus on the support that we give them that has some sort of a clinical tinge to it. But the schools were saying, I don't know if our kids need more therapy. They need more identification and hands-on support around social determinants of health. And DMH, in coordination with the CE's office and the Human Rights Commission, developed the behavioral health services of Ulster. I'm sorry, you guys are in my hearing. Yes, behavioral health services of Ulster County Schools RFP based on the feedback received from those school districts. Next slide. Thank you. So goals of the RFP, to buttress existing services available both in school and in the community, provide intensive time-limited clinical intervention and care coordination to Ulster County students, Want to come back to that clinical piece, and I'll speak to it a little bit more when we talk to about the staffing. So the staff may have the ability to do the clinical intervention. They have the experience, but that's not necessarily where the focus is going to be, and we'll talk about that a little later. The goal would be to be a part of the school community at each of our 9 districts and act as a link between school, community, and family. Services will be targeted toward middle school age youth, identified by the school as being able to benefit from targeted support, brief intervention, and linkage to community resources. And we'll aim to promote overall wellness at school and home and build protective factors to offset the effects of trauma and directly target social determinants of health. One of the headlines that I didn't touch on that first slide was around gun violence. And though a youth may not be experiencing gun violence in their home, or they may not have access to guns or what have you, living in a community where gun violence is prevalent in itself is a trauma. And so, you know, this program would be helping to be able to identify those traumas and really develop a plan for someone to be able, for one of our youth to be able to manage with it at home. Next slide. Staff support. So operate teams of 1 licensed master clinical social worker or licensed mental health counselor and 1 care manager. And so just speaking to this a little bit, even though the school said that the kids don't necessarily need more therapy, as it were to say, we thought that it would be important for the team member to have the ability to do assessment and make assessment in working with kids on those social determinants of health or even around wellness interventions and the yoga and everything. They still need to have the ability to identify when they see someone that is struggling with a mental illness. And so we thought that the staff should have that experience, but not necessarily have that be the limitation of the interventions that they can offer. So they'll be a clinician, but then there will also be a bachelor's level care manager to work in a dyad and supporting youth, families, and schools. The teams will provide face-to-face sessions with the youth, family support sessions, and the sessions is really just those meetings. Family support with the youth and their parent, caregiver, at least monthly, ongoing communication and meetings with school staff is needed. Linkage to community supports and resources for both the youth and the family, and coordination with other involved providers, including but not limited to mental health, juvenile justice, social service, and primary care. And I know that we had talked about Thomasine had talked about the SPOA pieces, but we are looking and we were successful in getting a system of care grant. And system of care is really a framework in which a county can choose to support youth and families, knowing that youth and families cross over many systems. They may cross between mental health, DSS, probation, the school, definitely. And so the system of care brings all of that together. And if you see that last bullet about coordination of all of those involved providers, our system of care work is really going to include this mental health and programs, mental health in schools program. And I don't know if Thomasine, if you can speak to that a little bit in more detail.
Yes, and definitely, you know, it's one of our guiding principles for the system of care of having a comprehensive array of services and supports. And this is, as Tara said, it's not going to be the same as the SPOA with the clinical, needing that clinical piece, the diagnosis beforehand. This is going to add to what we are missing from our system of care. We're missing the way that students can access the supports without having the already confirmed diagnosis. And, you know, like our mission for the system of care is welcoming all families with complex issues into caring relationships with a variety of providers across all systems of care. And this is really, you know, this additional holistic approach of making sure that we are bridging the family to the community to the schools and like really, really looping together all our services holistically from county to community to the families.
Thank you.
Thomasine, can I ask a quick question? I'm sorry.
Sure.
What's the process of SPOA? Like, I'm trying to understand what the barriers are. Is this lowering barriers?
Yes, it is reducing a barrier.
Right. Yes. That's what I'm wondering. Because could you talk to us a little bit about how this would do that?
Yeah. So sometimes I'll get a SPOLA application, right, from a school social worker. A lot of school social workers are sending me school, you know, applications, but sometimes the youth, they don't have diagnoses. So if they don't have a confirmed diagnosis, I'm not able to serve them through SPOA because they would have to have two identified mental health diagnoses in order to access services. So, you know, it's hard because these students are high in need and we try to figure out how we can get them assessed. And, you know, so we're trying to run around and trying to figure out how we can support the youth. So this would reduce an immense barrier to just be able to get the youth connected to services without having to worry about an already identified mental health diagnosis, but then get them connected to treatment, you know? So this would really serve all those students that I'm not able to serve through SPOA. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our target population, as I said, are middle school students, and youth will be identified by schools to be candidates for the program. And these are some of the concerns that a youth could be identified with. School refusal, as Thomasine had mentioned, is we're seeing a rise in that in the SPOA applications, family concerns, peer conflicts, and in adverse childhood experiences. Next slide. Activities of support, again, definitely things that are a little bit more concrete. Teams will work with youth on goals related to the trauma, mental health, substance use prevention or intervention, vocational, maybe getting a job, housing instability, food insecurity, definitely broadening the supports outside of the clinical realm. Next slide. And definitely we love this one because as clinicians, we're not always able to engage in the yoga and the physical exercise and the creative expression. And those also help with the anger management, getting kids to be able to have a toolbox of self-care practices for when they're sitting down for finals. You know, these supports would be able to help them to develop that. Next slide. So we put out the proposals, put out the RFP. We received three proposals. We convened a RFP committee that reviewed all of the proposals. There has not yet been an awardee that has been notified. However, we're enthusiastic about the opportunity to partner with one of the applicants on the program. Next slide. So just in terms of how this program would meet ARPA committee criteria, trying to see if I can run through some of this quickly, but I am going to read this first one because I think that it is pivotal. The U.S. Treasury's final rule recognizes the ways in which the public health emergency has impacted mental health and substance use challenges for Americans. One of the primary categories for eligible use for this funds are in public health, which includes behavioral health care. So we think that we're targeting how the ARPA committee can be identifying ways to spend these dollars. And also just in terms of equity distribution, we're putting out a wide net in terms of all of the districts in our county and then focusing on the middle school age youth. So in doing that and having the net be as wide, we will definitely capture underserved and vulnerable populations of kids. The community impact developed with a wide outreach to all school districts in the county. It was really important not to hand them a program, but to really get a sense of what could really be helpful. It serves the entire county and strengthens the vital public services. And then because we are in the midst of developing our system of care, it ties right into that work. Financial management, we are simultaneously helping districts to seek other sources of funding that can do similar work. And we're also looking to see if we could make use of the opioid settlement funding. I will just the last thing that I'll leave you with is the time sensitivity around this, because we'd love to be able to plan it so that it could be implemented for a fall launch. And I thank you guys so much for your time.
Thank you so much for that detailed presentation. I appreciate that. If we could unshare the screen so we can see each other, that'd be great. And I want to open this up. I think one more, if we could unshare this other screen. We're still seeing somebody's screen here. Perfect. The one question that I'm going to lead with, because it's the one that I keep hearing over and over again, is, okay, so if we give this ARPA funding, then where's the funding come from afterwards for this program?
Yeah, I could speak to that. I think, I guess one thing to lead off with is we're always looking for grant opportunities. And right now at the state level, there are so many grant opportunities that could be used for this. So we would look into that. Other thing I would say is that this is really such an important issue that we would be open to looking at this as a pilot. And if it goes well, and if we all agree that it's a priority, we could consider it as part of sort of something that the county supports moving forward.
Thank you. Chairwoman Martels.
Thank you. And I'm sorry I missed the very beginning of the presentation. I'm trying to shuttle between two meetings that are scheduled at the exact same time. But thank you very much. I saw at least two-thirds of it. I do have a couple questions. One is to kind of follow on to Legislator Criswell's question, and that's to try to understand, I know that New York State Mental Health announced $50 million in funding for schools directly for mental health initiatives. I don't know a lot about it, but my understanding is it's $500,000 a school per year over the course of years. And I'm wondering, and I know our school districts also got significant ARP funding themselves. And so, I think as we began this conversation with the legislation that former legislator Parity brought forward, we all agreed that this is a priority and of critical importance. And then on the legislative end, we weren't as engaged in the process that got us to this point in terms of this proposal that's come forward. I know that an RFP went out, but that was without legislative input. And so I'm sort of wondering, where are the schools at and what have they spent their ARP funds on? And are they investing in their own schools? And how is the interface with this proposal going to work at the school level? How engaged have we gotten with the stakeholders? Have we spoken to all the superintendents at all the schools? Have we had those kinds of sit downs with all the stakeholders already?
Yes. That's where we started, was with conversations with the school districts. So want to make sure in terms of trying to investigate what are the best ways that the Department of Mental Health would be able to complement what they're doing within their own school districts. A lot of those conversations spoke to increasing behavioral health staff, but their plans were really to do what they focus on, which is to create an environment for students to learn. So the resources would remain on the school district campus. If it was more social workers, it would be more social workers to see, the kids while they're there. This program is really to help to bridge between the school district campus and the community. Kids spend the majority of their time in school. We get a lot of the information about what their challenges are, what their successes are, what they do well in, what may be a barrier. But then all of that great information leaves at school, and then the community picks up in a different way. This program bridges the both. So the staff would have the ability to be in school conversations with the behavioral health staff. What we talked about in our earlier meetings with the districts were, do you guys have regular staff meetings, or do you have regular training days, or do you have regular times in which this staff would be able to participate so that they can learn each school community and know how to better reinforce what you guys are using as support in the community? And that's really what it's about. It's great that the schools will put their resources to making sure that kids can learn, but the learning also in trying to increase that ability to learn, there needs to be some real recognition about challenges that are happening in the community. And that's what this program will have the ability to do. Even concretely, we were talking about, gee, where will the office be? We don't need a really big footprint anywhere in terms of office space. These guys shouldn't be necessarily in a school specifically all day. They should be in the community, in homes, at Dunkin' Donuts, if that's where the kid is going after school. You know, wherever kids are is where they should be. But because we have the agreement with the schools, we're not locked out, which is where other programs will struggle, in that the schools have a hard time allowing outsiders in for privacy reasons, for lots of reasons. So we developed this program with the schools so that we would be able to jump over those barriers right at the beginning.
May I ask a follow-on?
Absolutely.
So have we analyzed both whether or not the schools are applying for that $500,000, a portion of that $50 million funding, and which schools are, and also which, if any, schools are spending their ARPA funds on improving their mental health services within the school? Because I imagine there's a wide range of how school districts are utilizing their ARPA funds. Do we have answers to those questions?
I will say that I have anecdotal. I can't say that necessarily we have an analyzed report that says Ontiora spends $50,000 on what XYZ. I don't have that.
But Tara, to the other question about the mental health in schools grant, we've been working with those school districts to apply to the grant, right? Could you speak to which ones are eligible? And
I can. There are two districts in particular that have been identified for meeting criteria for dollars that would mimic a program like this within the school district. That's Kingston and that's Ellenville. We have had two conference calls with both of the behavioral health and superintendent staff for these school districts in consultation of applying for these grants. So we are sort of putting our resources to bear in any way in helping to get this done. And we continue to scan for grants that may be available. There seems to be a lot that's coming out. And because we will have the ability, because of the staffing that our county exec and the budget and all of our legislators had agreed to us, we'll have the staffing resource to provide the time and consultation for our districts. And we've started that already.
So just to be clear, you're seeing this initial $750,000 as this pilot, the seed funding, whatever we want to call it, and then you're going to be trying to seek it from additional sources outside. I guess my nervousness is with any program like this, you know, you put the money in, we don't want to see it die on the vine. You know, it's a substantial investment. It's a great program, in my opinion. I don't want to see us put this money into it and then all of a sudden we don't have real funds lined up to make it a long-term project. So can you speak to my fears a little bit?
When it comes to dollars, I usually pivot to Joanna somewhat. I'm not sure. Outside of knowing that we are always scanning for additional grant funding, I do know that the county exec has spoken to some commitment to continuing.
Sure. I mean, I just, the only thing I would say is just to sort of reiterate what I said earlier, which is that we think this is a big priority. And so if it goes well and everybody's in agreement, we would be supportive of looking at it as an ongoing investment.
Okay, thank you. Legislator Sperry and then Legislator Nolan, I see your hand.
I'm not sure if you mentioned it, but I was just wondering, you were talking about the teams that are going to be facilitating this work, and I was just wondering how many teams you imagine are going to be facilitating the work, just so I have a better idea of how many people are going to need to be employed under this program.
Five teams
that are going to be serving all of the school districts in Ulster County.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Legislator Nolan?
Thank you. I think the questions about the sustainability of the program are valid. What I'm excited about in hearing this is that getting this program started, it is already going over a hurdle. When I was in the legislature previously, Jonathan Heppner and I met, Legislator Heppner and I met with the school board at Onteora, and they wanted something like this, but kind of administrative and the logistic hurdles to it were real, real barriers. I think more than a funding in some ways. And so this seems to have jump-started and maybe leaping over that barrier for this broad population of students. You know, the students who have a diagnosis are getting services, but the teachers and the school board were very concerned about the broader population and how to get them this kind of informal access to settings in which they might find out about resources or receive a diagnosis even potentially. So in thinking of this as a pilot, I think that it gets past one of the biggest parts of the difficulty in connecting county mental health resources with school populations. And then the money, I think, can be, then you have the pilot to go after pots of money saying, we're doing this, we need to fund it. And if you don't have anything going, then it's harder to go after funding. You know, it's sometimes hard to get money for a program that doesn't yet exist.
Thank you for that insight. Appreciate it. Legislator Chairwoman Bartels.
Thank you. So the other question that I have is a little bit more of a kind of a functional question. Like in the backup to the information, you include the RFP, but you don't include the responses to the RFP. So I don't know if you've chosen someone, but I guess I'm just a little confused because you're asking for ARP $750,000 in ARP funds, but at the same time you sent a proposal out, you know, for proposals for behavioral health programming. So, I mean, have the proposals come back? Have you selected someone? Where are you at with the RFP process? Like this is something you're resourcing out for. It's not something we're doing within the county. So you're asking for funding for a program that you've gone out to RFP for, but we don't have the details on what the responses are that we're actually being requested to fund.
Right. I can answer to the process in that we did receive the three proposals. We have not notified an awardee. We did have an interview with one of the proposers or the provider that submitted the proposal. We have narrowed down that there is a provider that we would like to be able to partner with, but we have not gone into any final stages of making that identification.
So is that RFP something that you would share with this committee?
I think in terms of the purchasing process, the review is restricted to like the RFP review committee.
Okay.
I
understand Chairwoman Bartels' question though, you know, we're being asked to fund this, but we don't actually know who we're funding. I mean, it's being funneled through your office, but you know, who is it that is actually going to get the contract? I think is that what you're asking, Chairwoman Bartels?
It is what I'm asking, but I'm asking that and, you know, and more because there's a scope, the RFP as presented has a scope of work, but you know, I assume that the responses are going to vary in how they handle that scope of work and what they're exactly proposing to do and how much it costs. Like this right, what's now before us is a resolution asking for, which in general I don't love when we, you know, when we transmit, but the RFP went out before transmitting what you want to spend. So I'm guessing you have a sense of what the numbers have come back as. But you know, you're asking for funding, but the details are going to be from one organization to the next. I'm not asking to be a part of the RFP selection commission, but again, you know, we're outsourcing this and there's going to be details in those responses that you know, would be important to really understanding the full implications of the program. So, you know, I guess I'm saying that I feel like at this moment, it's a little premature. I feel it's a little premature to move forward to funding this before I had a fuller sense of what exactly it is we're going to do with the proposed vendor, and also an understanding of the interface with the schools. Like, I appreciate that you've reached out to the schools, but I don't, you know, have they all, again, I would want to know what they're all currently doing and how it's going to interface, and also if they're all receptive to allowing this program to be brought into their districts.
Could I respond?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that we wanted to kind of do the order of operations in the right order. So we were hoping to get the funding approval first, and then we would come back next month on the actual contract award, because we were advised by purchasing, obviously you don't want to make a contract award without the funding approval. So that's why that order is in the way that it is. And in terms of, I guess I've tried to be as vague as possible, but in terms of the provider that we want to contract with, what they proposed was very much in line. Their response was very much in line with everything that we just described. And the budget submission was also very much in line with what we had put out there, which was around $1 million, which is why we're asking for $750 in ARPA and the remainder in opioid settlement funds.
If I can also just answer to the one piece, which I think is important, is that in our conversations with the school districts, they were eager to have this program in their districts, and all nine of them did agree to allow for the program to be implemented in their district.
Thank you. Legislator Nolan, I saw you had your hand up. Do you still want to?
Thank you. Those two responses address points that I was going to make.
Great. Thank you very much. Other committee members have questions? Legislator Levine.
Thank you, by the way.
We all want to say happy birthday to you, Legislator.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm very appreciative of that. Thank you. But as I'm driving, I didn't have a chance to really get into the details on the PowerPoint presentation, so forgive me if this was addressed before. But in regards to the question from Legislator Sperry from before, I know that the answer was given in terms of that there were five proposed teams to be covering all of the school districts in the county. But I wasn't sure if the information was provided as to how many employees per team were proposed, and if those five teams are going to each have like a geographic region that they're going to cover, or are they all going to be going out throughout the county as needed, or are they going to be assigned to different regions of the county? So thank you for the answers to that question, to those questions. Thank you.
Yes, it's a two-person team. We're expecting to have 10, is that right, 10 employees in total that will be hired. Kingston will have a team of their own, and then the remaining teams will be split up between the other districts.
Thank you. Other questions from, yes, Chairwoman Bartels.
Are the employees going to be county employees?
No, they will be employees of the awardee for the RFP.
Okay.
If I see no other questions, I'd like to move this along. What I'd like to do with the process of this is take no action on this tonight. We're going to send out our scoring sheets to all committee members. If you have questions between now and the deadline for scoring for this, which would be no later than Monday, June 6th at noon, if you could please send those questions to Amber. Is that correct, Amber? And then you'll funnel them to whoever needs to get them. So if you have questions on that, please send them to Amber. We'll send out a scoring sheet on this resolution, get the scores back by Monday the 6th, and then we will be voting on this at the June 15th ARPA meeting. Thank you very much for the presentation on this. I think it's really important work, and we appreciate your time on this. We are going to move on now. So we still don't have Legislator Stewart, so I'm going to assume that we are not. Legislator Corcoran, did you?
I just have to go because I got that other meeting I'm going to take off on. So thank you.
Thank you for your time. All right. So since Legislator Stewart is not here, I think we are going to just continue moving on. So the next that I have on our list is the food security program. And I believe that Deputy Executive Kelly is going to speak to that. And you're going to give us an update on the program itself and also the conversation that's going on with the community kitchen.
That's actually going to be Nate Litwin.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yep, I'm glad to present on that. So the last time we discussed this, there was a presentation from Amanda LaValle in the planning office, Deputy Director for Planning, who presented in depth on food security and access. And then there is another initiative discussed regarding community kitchens. And the goal is to try to see if we can combine that into one resolution and bring it forward to this committee. I can say that I have reached out to Community Action again. First, we did some community outreach. We met with Novo because we wanted to see what we didn't want there to be multiple things being funded for kitchens in the Kingston area. That wouldn't be efficient. And we did find that Novo is providing funding to the Annie Murphy Neighborhood Center. It will not have a walk-in cooler, but that is something that will go forward and we'll have a kitchen. But Novo, they also were stated that their service area is the Broadway area, Midtown for Kingston. So when it came to community action, that kitchen is not in their service area. And they kind of provided, you know, just background information on other things they'd looked at. But the one that was kind of more of a yes regarding going forward with the kitchen is that neighborhood center. The ARP division, we went and we visited with Community Action. We saw the kitchen. We got a sense. We talked to the cook who was there. We got a sense of the needs of the kitchen. It is in rough shape. It is something that's been part of the community for a long time. It is providing a lot of the different things that they say. This is kind of a personal thought, but it looked to me like there was a lot of services going out of that kitchen, including providing food and providing a resource center for one thing I learned was that, and I didn't know it, is that food trucks, for example, due to health laws need to be associated with an actual physical kitchen location. So there's a lot of small businesses that simply need to be associated that way. I did make clear that the primary purposes of the funding would be for emergency use of the kitchen and also providing food to community members. And so generally it was a good visit. And so I'm just here to report that I feel comfortable about, and I know that's not exactly my role. I definitely feel like my role is more administrative, but at least I've had some information gathering and can report it to the committee. And that I think for purposes of a resolution, I think the money would be wisely used and it should go into the food security and access resolution. The piece that I think still needs work to put it all together, because there is a number of ideas and good ideas and uses, but I think we need more work to understand Ellenville and how a kitchen might be created there. And so that's just the piece that's left, and I hope to have that resolved in the resolution in front of this committee for next month.
Nate, can I ask, what was the thinking behind combining these two, because we had them separated out. In my thinking, they were separated out. What was the thinking in bringing this together?
I think that was something that was created through the discussion process. They could be separate, and certainly the food security and access could move right away, in my opinion, from what's been presented and what's been put together.
That's why I was asking, because to me it felt like that was solidly thought through. It seemed like it was almost ready to go, and that the community kitchen had more work to do. And so I was just curious why all of a sudden it seemed to be pulled together. Deputy Executive Kelly, do you have an answer to that?
Yeah, I think it came out of the last meeting that we all had, where the discussion kind of dovetailed together between the community kitchens and food security and access. So they're as easily pulled apart as they are put back together. So we wouldn't have an issue either way.
Any other committee members have any thoughts on that, pulling these two apart, or do we feel like they should be put together? Chairwoman Bartels?
Well, not necessarily on pulling them apart, but I do and again, I apologize because I'm trying to toggle between two meetings, but in terms of the community kitchens, and I appreciate the work, Nate, that you did just in terms of assessing what else is out there, because we definitely don't want to duplicate. But I also wanted to remind, if it hadn't been said yet, that I think there's value to having a discussion also about a community kitchen in the southern end of the county, whether that's on either side of on either side of the mountain, basically. Like, it could be the Ellenville region, it could be the Shangam, Marlboro, Highland region. I'm actually interested. I would like to see Community Action's community kitchen as well. I mean, I really see the possibility of these community kitchens as serving so many roles, as Nate alluded to from what he learned, but also, you know, they're equal parts business incubators as, you know, food security and education hubs. So the idea that we put all of our energy in Kingston, I think, is something we need to think about. I think Southern presence for these would be very, very welcome and would be utilized. I even actually, although I haven't reached out, thought that it might make sense somehow in association with the fairgrounds. I don't know, you know, something that potentially a conversation with Cornell Cooperative and the Ag Society. As far as separating the ideas out, I would defer to the committee on that. I'm fine with that, but I personally am very interested in making sure that we're certain that we're covered in terms of the community kitchens, and I do want to think of them as plural.
Thank you for that. I'm really thinking that this community kitchens conversation is going to take a bit of time, and I feel like it would be actually smart for us to separate this back out again and bring the Cornell Cooperative to the front again as it was proposed. How do other committee members feel about that? Is there any opposition to that? I'm seeing thumbs up. Deputy Executive Kelly, does that work for you?
Yes, Chair, that works fine. And just to follow on to Chair Bartels' statement there is we're 100% in support of doing something in the southern end of the county as well. So I don't think it's a successful program if we don't.
Okay, great. So we're going to separate this out. We'll move forward more systematically with the Cornell Cooperative at our next meeting. Hopefully we'll see that full resolution at that point. I'd love to actually get that in the scoring process sooner rather than later. And then we can take a little bit more time with the community kitchens conversation. Does that sound good with anybody? Any last thoughts on this? Great. All right, I'm gonna move us on to the Main Streets program. Legislator Hewitt, I'm sorry, I see your hand.
Thank you, Chair Criswell. I'm just pulling over. Give me one second so I can focus on my question. It's about the food security component. I listened to Amanda Laval's presentation, and she started by saying that the pandemic revealed weaknesses in our supply chains. And if we run out of food again, I feel that the food security component addresses how we can get food to people, especially by cooking and distributing it. But I don't feel like it addresses how to improve our supply chains. For example, I just read an article about how four primary grain crops in the world are failing right now because of climate crises and either drought or flooding. So how do we get our grains locally and our meats locally, our cheeses locally, and how are we incentivizing that?
Thank you for that. And I know that there's some conversations about a local meat distribution process. So I think it seems like we have a lot of focus on food security. So maybe we've got three things going now at this point. We've got the kitchens, we've got the conversation that we're having with Cornell Cooperative, and then we've got a distribution conversation going on at the same time. So I'd say, Legislator Hewitt, if you have some specific ideas about that, please bring them forward. And Legislator Sperry, if you want to bring your ideas forward with I believe it's Legislator Letts that you're having conversations with, I'd encourage you to bring that forward as well. So
great. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you very much. All right, moving on to Mr. Wiedemann, if you would give us a little overview of the project that you're bringing before us.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Criswell. Can I share my screen? I'm going to try. Oh, yeah, it looks like it's letting me. So I'm going to just do a quick, not very fancy PowerPoint presentation that I think highlights what I believe was shared with the members of the committee. Can you see my screen? Yes, good. So the concept here, which was arrived at, I think, through a confluence of conversations with businesses that we have, but also I know Legislator Criswell and I had the opportunity to visit one business in Saugerties that I think is doing some really exciting things that started me at least thinking along the lines of a program like this. And I would be eager to get feedback. This is kind of a preliminary proposal, really just to see how you all feel about it and to get some feedback and questions so that we can refine it. The idea is really to create a program that mirrors in some ways a successful state program called the New York Main Streets Program. It really builds on work that's been happening in the county for quite some time. And I can, you know, point to Dennis Doyle, who I know I actually remember working with him years ago on a New York Main Streets toolbox or a Ulster County Main Streets toolbox to try to make similar investments in our compact cores throughout the county. And those might be villages, hamlets, commercial strips, kind of all of the above, these places where there's a density of commercial uses, often mixed with some residential uses as well. So quick highlights of what the program proposes. It's to invest in these commercial cores to increase the economic vitality of those communities and to enhance community quality of life. We all know that the trend, you know, has been towards residences in these compact walkable areas. You can look to the walkability scores that have been driving, you know, significant portion of the attractiveness of certain communities in our county. And any conversation with a realtor will show you that that's a big attractive selling point in a lot of cases. And we have such great fabric in Ulster County in the small commercial cores that we do have. The funding would be proposed to be in two categories that mirrors in some ways the New York Main Streets program. One is in investments in the core itself, so a kind of geographic area that receives the investment. And the other is in an anchor institution that really anchors that commercial core. The maximum award would be something in the range of $250,000, obviously, depending on the allocation of funds and the number of awards that we would wish to make. And it seems reasonable to require some match. I haven't given a lot of thought to what that match would be. Be interested in feedback or thoughts from the committee on that. This is one where I think pretty expectedly we would see geographic diversity. There are commercial cores throughout the county, so I think we could really make sure that we get the word out and solicit those applications from the cores that are scattered throughout the community, everywhere from the northern part to all the way down into the southern part, all throughout the county. Hamlets, commercial strips, again, even places where I think I go into this in a little bit, the commercial core might be as small as a 1 square mile or even smaller. The request here just marks out $2 million of allocation of ARPA funds that would allow approximately 8 awards at that 250,000 level, which, by the way, feels like the amount that usually is necessary in order for substantial investment in either the core itself or in the anchor institution that'll help strengthen that core. And again, this leverages some past work done by the planning department and also the existing New York Main Streets program. So the document that was circulated gives a preliminary definition of these two different categories of funding. Commercial core would be a compact contiguous geographic area of no more than 1 square mile, but comprising no less than 5 independently owned and operated commercial facilities and where commercial uses are a significant portion of the current or historical land use. Anchor institutions, it's a business or organization that is either a large physical presence or a large destination, or could include some housing if there's an ability to add full-time year-round residents in a commercial core to add the mix of housing that can often strengthen the commercial presence in that core. The objectives, this is, again, for feedback, but the objectives here that, feel important to outline to make sure that we're headed towards something that we all can agree is a good thing for our communities. Objective one, support physical improvements to both the anchor institutions and the compact cores. So the physical institutions could see things like interior renovations and alterations, building systems upgrades, especially, and we could give points to where such improvements provide energy effective, cost-effective options to improve building performance and efficiency. It could include exterior improvements such as facade work, landscaping, an outdoor space, or renewable energy installation on the building. And, it could include new infill construction. Often there's, a small vacant lot that could be developed and would add to the fabric of the commercial core. But in those cases, the thought would be to only award new infill construction where it meets certain performance standards. The second objective would be to strengthen placemaking efforts within these compact commercial cores. This is about really defining the place in order to make it more recognizable, more attractive, a higher quality of life. We could improve walkability and bikeability in the area. It could improve sidewalks or bike trails or bike paths, bike lanes. Could improve mobility more generally. We could talk about whether there's other forms of mobility that should be prioritized. Could beautify public spaces through things such as landscaping or public art. It could provide visitor amenities, open Wi-Fi networks or visitor information and signage. Preserve or enhance the long-term success of multiple businesses within the core. So that's the idea here. Examples that are common in the New York Main Street programs include things like a district-wide facade improvement program or a local area marketing program. And then the third objective would be to prepare communities and organizations to compete successfully for additional funding for these kinds of efforts. Again, the Main Streets program, for those that aren't aware, is one that is only really open to municipalities to apply for on behalf of either anchor institutions or their business districts. And I think we've seen some communities in Ulster County successfully use this funding. Kingston has had it in the past. I'm sure there are others as well. But we would like to position our downtown areas, our commercial cores, to be more competitive for this funding. And there's a number of ways that we could do that. One that we could look at right away is where there are applications that are not urgent, time-sensitive applications to this program. We could look to use this program as match to enhance the competitiveness of an application to the New York Main Streets program. And so we could look into that more and discuss that as a possibility. There are other programs too, Downtown Revitalization Initiative, which we know New Paltz and Ellenville have competed for in the past. There's a new New York Forward program that is similar, but it's going to focus on rural communities that the governor announced as part of the budget. And we're keeping track of that as it rolls out to see if there's opportunities for that as well. And then there's plenty of other opportunities that we work with regularly with businesses and communities to help strengthen these cores. And so we'd be looking to leverage this funding to support additional funding from those sources. The implementation plan, we try to leverage some of the existing kind of organizational infrastructure that we have from other competitive programs funded with ARPA funding, the Nonprofit Recovery and Resiliency, the CARES 2 and Water and Sewer programs that have been recently advanced. The thought here, as with the CARES 2 program, would be to subaward to UCEDA for implementation subject to a contract that would be approved by the legislature, and to have a joint legislative executive evaluation committee that would score the applications. And that scoring evaluation would be based on a scoring rubric, which I've highlighted some of the things I would think would be in it, but we could design that in consultation with the legislature. And then proposed timeline, you know, I think this is rough at this point, but just kind of giving a sense that I think we could roll this out fairly quickly, get to the point of announcing and promoting a request for applications, spend some time collecting and evaluating those applications, and then move into monitoring and reporting on the progress of the contracts that are awarded for execution of projects. That's the quick summary. I'll turn it back over to you, Chair Quisenberry.
That's great. Thank you so much. If you could stop sharing your screen then, we'll see each other. So committee, I want to open this up to questions. Thank you very much for that presentation. It was thorough and appreciate that.
Sure.
Committee members. Okay, anybody else on the Chairwoman Bartels?
Just briefly, you know, first of all, I want to thank Tim for the presentation and as always, his thoughtfulness and his advocacy, which is, you know, I know you're the perfect person for this job, that you're always advocating for the businesses in our communities. And that's why we need you there. I'm just going to say I'm feeling very, I had this conversation earlier with Deputy Executive Kelly, and then via back and forth with Amber, just to confirm, you know, where we're at financially. And, you know, I'm feeling a sense of urgency, like we've committed so much of this already. And what I realized today in talking to Deputy Executive Kelly is that, we've actually expended less than I feel like we've expended. Like I'm feeling like we're really at the last few decisions, and we may be depending on how much we want to spend. But so at this stage of the game, it's going to be the decisions get all the more difficult because there's less funding. And I'm not saying that to be specific about this proposal, but I would very much want to know, when you speak about the Main Streets program, functionally how it's different. Like maybe there's a way we could spend less of this money by putting together our own Main Streets program, but maybe focus on the last thing that you said, which is in terms of helping our communities with writing grants. And I'm starting to think that maybe that's something as a county that we could think about in a broader sense, not just as it relates to ARPA, because I think a lot of communities, there's very few that probably have their own grant writers, and there's a ton of missed opportunities. And when Gardner succeeds, when Saugerty succeeds, when New Paltz, when Ellenville, then we all succeed, then Ulster County succeeds, right? So maybe we should think about how we might facilitate. I mean, maybe we should think about a grant writer position in the county that would be tasked with assisting communities on these subjects. And again, I'm saying this out of that sense of realizing we're reaching the end of these funds, maybe not as quickly as I thought this morning, but we're reaching the end of these funds. But there's a lot that's left on the table out there all the time for lack of certain resources and skills. So thank you for bringing that to my attention again, Tim, because I think it's something we should be talking about, not just in this committee, but as budget time approaches.
Thank you. Deputy Executive Kelly.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to briefly follow on to a point Chair Bartels just made on grant writing. I did recently just see Capital Region BOCES actually has a position where they have a grant writer who does grants for the schools. They basically treat the individual school districts that are a participant as their clients. So I do think it's in every conversation that I have, whether it's internally with the team or externally with the municipalities. So hopefully, I think the timing's right to have that conversation as we start to develop the 2023 budget. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Legislator Nolan, I see your hand.
Yes, thank you. Chair Criswell. This would be a little bit of a tangent into something that's not on the agenda, but it relates to this issue about grant writing. Would that be appropriate now, or should I hold that for?
Can you hold that for a moment? I want to finish up with this project that we're talking about. Do we have Mr. Doyle?
Thank you. I just wanted to add on to what Mr. Kelly has had Deputy Executive Kelly has talked about. You should be aware, the committee should be aware that the County Planning Board continues to make communities aware of grant opportunities, including the most recent CFA grant, the Community Development Block Grant Funds, and others. We do regular sweeps of all the grants that are available and pull them out to committees. But there is a lack of capacity, both at our level and as well as at the community level for applications. And so some instances, what we're doing is we're encouraging nonprofits to work with communities because not all grants are eligible for on a municipal basis. Some of them are available on a nonprofit basis. And so working together as a nonprofit, a public-private partnership also makes a lot of sense with respect to this. I would also say with respect to Tim's proposal for a Main Street program, Main Street programs are standard fare nationally in terms of making sure that your Main Streets are vibrant and attractive and continue to essentially accommodate change. And there's a great program that exists in Sullivan County called Sullivan Renaissance, and it's funded through a nonprofit. And they've been very, very successful. And there are similar programs that have been initiated in Greene County, particularly in the town of Catskill, and there's others out there. We've had successful grant Main Street programs in Ulster County that funded areas in Rosendale and also funded Main Street program in Ellenville. A lot of some of the improvements and facade improvements that you see in Ellenville were actually through a Main Street program that came through the department. And we've done other work with respect to Main Streets, particularly Main Street funding became available after Hurricane Irene, and we accessed that money and were able to get a substantial amount of money out of after Irene for Main Street programs. So it's something that not only should the county consider looking at and how to do, it's also something that I think that it would involve the county partnering with its other institutions, particularly USITA, and its IDA in terms of looking to how Main Street programs can develop as well as its nonprofit institution.
Thank you very much. I like this program because I think it has a potential for wide reach. I also like the fact that it's got a match component. So municipalities or districts will be ponying up money themselves. I think it's going to encourage economic development, which I think is part of the charge for some of this ARPA money. So I see really good things in this. And I like Main Street programs too. I did a little bit of work with the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and they have Main Street programs that are very successful in identifying anchor institutions or anchor districts and helping revive them a bit, give them a little bit of a boost. So what I'm gonna suggest is that if we have specific questions or comments, we reach out to Mr. Wiedemann and connect with him about that. And I'd like to see this then move to sort of the next phase. So Tim, maybe you and I can connect directly about this. So thank you for that presentation. I appreciate it. And I'm gonna move us on to our last presentation, which is the Green Home Retrofit and Workforce Development. And that is gonna be Dennis Doyle, who's gonna do a presentation on that.
Well, thank you for the committee, and my apologies to the committee. I do not have a PowerPoint presentation, or perhaps maybe it's advantageous that I don't. I'm not sure anymore. I know that having sat through a number of them, that after a while, it's kind of nice to have a conversation rather than a presentation. So I apologize. I promise you that the next time I will have a presentation. And we'll go from there.
And actually, I'd like to recognize Legislator Green and her efforts to move this forward. So thank you, Legislator Green. I just wanted to recognize that publicly. Please continue on, Mr. Doyle.
So what this is about is literally it's an extension of the county's Green New Deal process and program. And what we're trying to do is when you look at the cost of and particularly what's happening right now, the cost of services, energy services, at the low and moderate income level. They make up a substantial proportion of low and moderate income individuals' budget. So the county went through a process which the legislature approved and have an existing community development block grant fund, which is geared to low toward improvements to low and moderate income households, homeowners. And those improvements essentially are to make them building ready so that they meet building code and they do major works. And that amount of funding was $800,000. It's one of the largest awards that the county has in the community development block grant sector. And as part of that, we had a conversation with respect to OCR, Office Community Renewal, and others about trying to figure out how we can do a deeper dive into energy conservation on the houses that we're working on with regard to efforts that we're doing in terms of code compliance. And we reached out to Citizens for Local Power. We reached out to our own our BOCES folks, as well as the current contractor for our housing rehab program, which is RUPCO. And then also talking to our Office of Employment Training in terms of what that would look like. And what we found is that the Citizens for Local Power have a existing program that they use that essentially is under capacity. They don't have the necessary capacity to bring up to speed. And they've requested that we help them do some of the share some of that administrative burden to bring that up to speed. They currently have funding from a nonprofit to have 16 interns paid to work with existing contractors. And the thought we had was that if we could help them in their capacity to manage that program, as well as then do work on existing housing to do deep energy dives, that we would solve two problems. One is we would do a workforce training program with them. Two is we would involve contractors that are currently engaged in workforce training. And three is we would end up doing housing work for low and moderate income homeowners to relieve them of some of the burdens of the cost of their current energy costs. And that program effectively looks like about somewhere in a neighborhood of about $350,000 to $400,000 going into actual program delivery. They would actually do work on the ground. And then some of the rest of that program would go to some administrative expenses associated with that, as well as hiring helping the Citizens for Local Power hire a full-time coordinator to allow them to increase not only their work with respect to this program, but their other work with respect to meeting the county's green energy goals. Looking at this, what we would anticipate doing is working with our existing contractor, RUPCO, with respect to the existing work that we're doing on the houses that are going through the community rehab program right now, and extending that community rehab program into deep energy dives in those houses. And we would do that working with contractors that have been pre-qualified by Citizens for Local Power in terms of their use of interns. And what we would end up doing is we do a call for bids on those houses using those pre-qualified contractors, and using those pre-qualified contractors, be able to essentially offer them multiple houses at a time in terms of the work that they've done. Now, we've had some experience in this back in the, I would say maybe 6 or 7 years ago. We wrote a grant through NYSERDA and through Office of Community Renewal to essentially install community solar projects, individual solar projects on low and moderate income housing. And we did that working with a call for proposals for those installations on those houses, and then having them be able to be offered to about 23 individual houses for low and moderate income families. So it's similar to that. Looking at any questions? I'm going to pause.
I had one quick question, I see your hand, Legislator Green. So I'm going to ask the question I asked about the mental health in schools project. So a lot of conversation that we've had about this ARPA money is that it's seed money, and that it's supposed to be a one-off fee that helps grow something that then can sustain itself. Can you speak to that?
I can, and I think that's a legitimate concern for a number of these projects in terms of how do we make sure that they're sustainable long term. And what I would tell you is that we have been successful with housing rehab projects on a regular basis with respect to looking at community development block grant funds. So that's the first piece. Is one is our success would suggest that moving forward, adding this component to our normal application process for housing rehab would be successful. That's the first thing. The second thing that I would say to you is that there's a commitment for New York State to do about 20,000 housing retrofits on a regular basis, and that's in the state budget. Having a program as a pilot set up, ready to go with the necessary administrative capacity available to it is one way that when that investment allows you to essentially go to the funding sources and say, raise your hand and say, hey, we're ready to go. And we think that we can deliver 20 units, 30 units, whatever number of units we are. And the focus that we already have is on low and moderate income housing. And that's the focus that the state is telling us is where they're going to put their money moving forward.
So that's why
I think it's sustainable. Is it a guarantee? I can't guarantee it.
Right. But it's really the same argument that they're making for the mental health program, that if the pilot is up and running, that there's some success shown, that that puts you to the front of the line almost when you're looking for additional support. So I get what you're saying there.
I would say that similar to the mental health program that you're talking about, the impact on the school age kids with respect to the pandemic is abnormal in terms of the need for mental health programs. So even if it's not sustainable, doing it now makes a whole lot of sense. The same thing here, the impact on energy costs that we're seeing right now, where heating oil is going to be $6 a gallon come this winter, and what we're seeing in terms of electricity costs, even if it's not sustainable, working through that process and getting it up and running and having that conversation out in the community with respect to energy efficiency and how to do it and getting the contractors so that they have the necessary workforce to do it, because that's what's also at stake here is providing the contractors the workforce. It's worth doing now. And I'm fairly certain that we'll be successful in future community development block grants if we're not successful in other grants that are going to come out from the state with respect to this. The commitment for climate change efforts from a low and moderate income perspective is huge in this state of New York.
Great. Thank you. Legislator Green.
Yeah, I want to thank Director Doyle for an excellent presentation and concept. I want to start with just mentioning that CPA, that's the Climate Act. CLP, the organization with Empower Kingston, has really created a life-changing program by combining what the state is calling young people from disadvantaged communities. I prefer the term priority communities, giving them hands-on and academic, information to start a career that they might not otherwise consider. The other thing is, in addition to state funding, sooner or later, Build Back Better is going to get passed, and that's going to present substantial funding for, in New York, those, was it 20,000 or 200,000 buildings that need to be retrofitted to meet the state's climate action goals, which include 70% renewable, but also 85% emission reductions. And I just want to give one personal anecdote that some of my colleagues have already heard, but just because it's so relevant. And that is this house that I'm in right now, I was able to get a grant from NYSERDA to do a deep energy retrofit. And in November, my boiler went out and I scrambled to decide, am I going to do ground source heat pump or air source heat pump? And in the meantime, it was getting cold. So I borrowed a couple of small space heaters from my neighbor. And I got through the entire winter with two small space heaters. My bills prior to the deep energy retrofit were three times higher than my bills after the deep energy retrofit. So I just want to share some personal experience because it makes it real for me. And it's why I'm so passionate about this multi-benefit. I think the term is co-benefits in terms of training for a real climate need that will be met, needs to be met within the next decade. It provides training and employment. It enhances our green careers pathway. BOCES and others can also be involved, and it creates a successful pilot project that will put us at the top of the list for federal and state money that are coming down the pike. So, and it's also a very, I didn't know the amount until Dennis just mentioned it, but I think it's a really reasonable amount. It's not because there's other funding already in place, but in order to create this pilot and actually do some energy retrofits, and it may also include some beneficial electrification. And I'll stop, but thank you so much for allowing this to be on today's agenda.
Thank you. And I really appreciate the workforce development component that got highlighted in this. It wasn't really in the forefront before, but now it is for me. And so, again, that's one of the priorities that we've been looking at. And so I appreciate that. Any committee members have questions for Director Doyle on this project? Anybody else who's on the call? Okay, well, we really appreciate that, and we will have further discussion about it. We'd like to actually see the documents when they are available, and if you could pass those along, that would be great. And I want to make a correction for Director Wiedemann's project. If anybody has questions about that, please funnel those through Amber. I want to make sure that the committee funnels all the questions through Amber so that she stays in the loop on everything and can sort of manage the flow back and forth. So thank you for that. All right, I'm going to move us along then. I think we have one piece of old business. Deputy Executive Kelly, I think you were going to update us on the broadband funding conversation that you had with Senator Hinchey.
Thank you, Chair. So not much of an, hold on, sorry. I'm a bit out of sorts today. Not much of a substantial update. The discussion I had with Senator Hinchey and her chief of staff, Leah Goldman, centered around the rule set that's gonna flow the money down. I don't know if Comptroller Gallagher's found out anything in the last 2 weeks. That was the last time I broached the topic, but we're basically waiting for ESD to come back down and tell us how it's gonna go. I know there's going to be pressure from people to get that done, but I haven't heard anything else as of this moment. But I just returned, so I'll continue. I see Marge has her hand up too.
Thank you. Comptroller Gallagher, please.
Yeah, I don't have any new news about state funding. I can just say that there are going to be gaps because the state funding is going to be cable fiber only. And we are going to have places that probably will not be served no matter what. So, and it may be inexpensive solutions to pilot test that. And I think, you know, Deputy Executive Kelly Planning Commissioner Doyle, myself, and Alan Macaluso from the IS department are all very interested in this, and we may be back to you with an inexpensive, very small, probably literally dustpan, dust in the dustpan size compared to the other projects, possible pilot to float by you, but it's going to take some time.
That's great. Thank you. And I think it's a really interesting idea. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that.
I'd like to add, if I could, Chair Criswell, that there are really good, robust maps now, that a map of Ulster County that you can zoom in. You can actually look at individual addresses because it has a layer that is individual structures. And we are collecting feedback. I'm getting it daily. We will be updating that map. Even Spectrum Charter has given us some feedback on the map, and you know how hard they are to work with. So I would just say everybody on this call who cares about broadband, please encourage your constituents to access the map. I will send a link to Amber to share out again with the committee. Thank you.
You're welcome. And the other thing I like about this, I think we could act quickly on this, and I think this could change people's lives very, very quickly. So I think this is something that we should really highly consider. Yes.
Sure, Criswell, can I add one thing, which is to say it in some cases, it's not just about infrastructure. It's about ability to pay. And and I think that that is a separate conversation, but one that also really could tap into ARPA funds. And it is something that should be considered because we have a lot of families who really struggled during the pandemic with their kids on cellular phones rather than directly connected. And again, it's just going to take a little bit of time. So we'll be back. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Director Doyle.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that add a couple of things. One is that the for better or for worse, broadband is one of those things where everybody's a player. And one of the things that we're looking at and working with is the county is engaged in essentially changing its communication systems for its emergency first responders. And that is a significant capital project. And we're looking at tower needs that extend essentially from Rosendale to Saugerties. We're currently under construction with in Saugerties, as well as up in the Shandaken Valley and into the Rochester area. And as we explore those towers and look at those, one of the things we're doing from a design perspective is making sure that we provide on those towers component, the ability of the tower load to handle components for A, cellular facilities, which are particularly important west of Phoenicia in the valley up there where there's no cell provider up there that provides decent service. And also for what they call point to multipoint broadband, which can extend up to 4 miles away from a tower and provide essentially download speeds that are similar to fiber broadband. And I think is one of the things that Controller Gallagher was talking about was there are other solutions besides on the ground or in the air fiber to essentially provide broadband service. And we're making sure that when we build towers that we have the ability to essentially accommodate those facilities in the future.
Great. Thank you for letting us know that. All right. Any other old business? Legislator Nolan?
This is not exactly old business. It might be actually new business, but it relates to the conversation earlier in regard to the grant writers and the crisis that farmers in Ulster County are facing. So we have with us tonight Jake Wiedemeyer, who's the Executive Director for Ulster County Soil and Water Conservation District. The chair of that committee, of that board, convened an emergency meeting earlier this week, yesterday, to help us all understand the nature of the crisis and to see what resources might be available in the county to help address it. And this is... The conversation was started by the rapidly increasing cost of diesel fuel and fertilizer, but there's also staffing issues and other problems that farmers are facing brought out by and exacerbated by the pandemic. So we're looking to put together a proposal, and one of the points that we identified that we thought might be very helpful would be a grant writer for types of grants that are not the usual grants that the district regularly and routinely gets, which the executive director handles and can continue doing. So I was very happy to hear that conversation in relationship to the Main Streets program and other things. But it may have particular applicability in regard to farmers who are often sole proprietors or small businesses and do not have the resources. That's not the reason they go into farming is not to sit down and write a grant proposal or administer one. We're kind of coming to you to let you know that we have identified this area that we haven't heard come before this committee yet. We haven't yet talked to the executive's office to find out which person or persons we should be working with on it, and to solicit people from the legislature who might want to work on it. But we want to flag it and see your initial reaction, and maybe Jake could say a word or two to elaborate what I've introduced here.
Absolutely. Feel free, Jake.
Thank you. So what the board of directors and myself have discussed is how to provide relief to farmers equitably. And one way of doing that is every farm files a Schedule F, right? Profits and losses from farming. And if we could look at their input costs compared to their income and what their net income is, that'd be a way to gauge, you know, some sort of agricultural relief. So we plan on doing another farm survey. We did one back in March. Kathy helped me with that, just to see the comfort level of sharing that information. And again, it would be confidential. We don't need anybody's social security numbers, but we would help administer, expediting this source of relief. But the way diesel fuel is and fertilizer, we're in the business of reducing fertilizer usage, with the Ulster County Soil and Water Conservation District. But it is required to make for farmers to have a decent yield. But some way to help them along, So we are open for different ideas, and we're still trying to, figure out an equitable way to, disseminate the funding, fairly amongst producers.
Thank you very much for that. Does anybody have questions regarding this? Legislator Sperry.
Has there been any conversation with Cornell yet? To see
Yes.
Okay. So what are the services that they provide in this realm already?
Cornell does more education and outreach, and we partner with them. The district is an action agency. We actually do implementation. So with New York State Ag and Markets Law, we actually do get funding for agricultural best management practices. We're dealing with climate resilient farming as well. So we're getting money into Ulster County for cover crops. Okay. We applied for a grant for a no-till drill to plant cover crops for pasture and hay renovations. So, Cornell is aware of that.
Maybe if I can add on to that, one of these programs are all really good, and they have been helping, and they're helping to make this transition. A lot of them are projects and implementation projects where there's a certain amount of administration, and so there's an additional burden that comes to farmers who, because of increased fuel costs and fertilizer costs, we're getting reports of people taking acreage out of production. And one of the members of the board reported 100 acres coming out of production. This is a downward spiral, because when you take acreage out of production, you're at great risk of reducing your income, and then the cycle perpetuates. So we're looking to try to do very short-term, targeted, very efficient, low administrative cost interventions. And we spent 2 hours last night brainstorming on what those could be, and thought that, you know, as Jake has presented, that maybe by identifying those farmers that have seen in the 2020 to 2022 timeframe the greatest loss of income, to somehow target relief to them that could be basically a cash infusion, perhaps with some incentives towards green transition, if we can do that in a way that doesn't itself create another hurdle. Looks like we've stimulated some conversation.
I see. So Deputy Executive Kelly and then Director Wiedemann, Legislative Green. Those are the order that I saw.
Thank you, Chair. You certainly piqued my interest this evening. Thank you for bringing this issue up. And I'm really looking forward to engaging in this conversation. I know Tim is as well. So let's put together a group of people and talk about how we can best assist. Thank you.
I cede my time, Mr. Chairman.
Legislator Green, if you would.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to put in a word for agrivoltaics as a way of promoting protecting prime farmland, but also keeping farms that are on the margin able to continue farming because of an additional source of revenue. And I know that there's at least one Ulster County-based developer, New York State Solar Farm out of Gardner, is looking to work with farmers to promote regenerative agriculture, or good farming practices that enhance the soil's ability to be a carbon sink, but also to install solar. We have been working with now close to 30 municipalities, encouraging them to take leadership in solar installation, installation of renewables and energy storage. And I'm hoping Rosendale will model that, but I do want to put in a plug for agrivoltaics for the committee that is working on this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, Legislator Nolan.
Just a quick reply on that. I agree, but I think that's a longer term solution than what we need right now. I mean, we really have a crisis situation. So I've actually been looking at electrification of farming. And I think there's some very exciting potential for that with electric tractors, for example, and other equipment that might help reduce energy burden, and that, because it would be green transition, might be something that we could provide perhaps for a match of installing a charging system at a farm site. So the Soil and Water District will continue to have this conversation, but we're going to try to compress it and maybe bring at least a conceptual project, perhaps at the mid-month meeting, if there's space on the agenda for it.
I'm glad you said that, because I wanted to kind of steer it back to ARPA funding. I know this conversation could go in a lot of directions, but I want us to stay focused on seed funding. That's not going to be something that has to be county sustainable necessarily. That's going to be an infusion that then can be, whether it's, I was thinking about, asking Director Wiedemann if farms have been applying to the small business programs, or is there some way that we can do a similar program to the small business programs that's actually focused specifically on farms, something along those lines. But I want to make sure that we're keeping it under the ARPA world of this idea of an infusion to assist and then not sustain in the long run. So I see Legislator Erner, and then I'll come to you, Jake.
Thank you, Chair Criswell. Certainly, we must have seen this coming, that the food obviously is one of the bare essentials. And so as the price of everything is going up, we clearly need to prepare for a different way of obtaining our food. And I think that speaks a lot to what can be done here in District 6. We need to find ways to support more people growing their own gardens and their lawns, sheep, not lawnmowers, as we decarbonize. And I would even go a step farther than Legislator Nolan, and we can certainly electrify vehicles, but we also need to figure out ways to simply use less energy intensive processes in our growing of food. And that, shudder the thought, but actually means a return to more human labor doing it, which if done in a different way from the historical way, which is highly oppressive, but it can in fact really be liberatory of individuals' time and other resources that they might otherwise have to spend on food, when in fact more of us could participate in growing our own food. I could refer those of us here to several books by the first farmer that I lived with. Her name was Sharon Astick, and she wrote A Depletion in Abundance, A Nation of Farmers, and a few other books, which put out a call for and a plan for how more could grow their own and how that could be supported through government and community partnerships. Those books are about 10, 15 years old at this point. But anyway, just I appreciate this conversation, and I want to continue to be a part of it as a grower myself. Thank you.
Thank you for those thoughts. Appreciate it. Jake, I'm sorry. Tell me your last name again. I'm calling you Jake, and I should be more formal, but.
Wiedermeyer.
Mr. Wiedermeyer.
When you said Wiederman, I would pay attention. Kathy did bring up using tractors that rely on electric, and I'm a farmer too, and I have gas and diesel. And what surprised me is that there's not a lot available right now. Caterpillar has perfected that technology. John Deere just came out with the tractor, so it is available. But if we bought a John Deere electric over diesel tractor, half the county would want it. We need a fleet of them, you know. And the good news is that technology will be adopted over time with the significant fuel savings. That's good news. So the technology is out there. Another thing is, like, we focus heavily on soil health. And the good news is we found somebody to backfill my old position, who's a certified crop advisor like me. So we're going to be running all over the county assisting with farmers to reduce fertilizer inputs. And in the past, we have gone from traditional fertilizers to poultry manure for the grain and soybean crops. And that has been a significant savings. And we're going to expand our cover crop program.
Great. Thank you so much. And I do want to keep, this is a really interesting conversation. This is the ARPA committee, so I do want to keep us focused on what our tasks are here. So I know that this conversation could go on for another hour, but I'm going to move us along and keep us on our task here, which is spending our funds. Yes, I recognize you, legislator.
It's just one sentence, and that is, I want to caution us that if we move to beneficial electrification before we put the renewable energy infrastructure in place with storage and efficiency, we're going to end up burning more fossil fuel anyway. So I don't object to beneficial electrification, whether it be for buildings or transportation or farm equipment. But I just really want to stress the need to get the renewable energy infrastructure in place. Otherwise, it can sort of backfire. And I won't say anything more. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to give somebody the last word. Who wants the last word here? Nate, I saw your hand up. Are you going to take the last word?
Sure. It is on point. Through the nonprofit grant, and despite all of our best efforts to only get 501c3s and 501c19s, veteran services organizations to apply, we still had a nonprofit agricultural business, an agricultural nonprofit apply. so I just wanted to share that information because it was, I'd have to look at the application again to be totally sure exactly all the circumstances, but it was compelling. They put a lot of effort in. They were, I believe, the only applicant that went through the additional process of fiscal sponsorship, but they're a 501c8, so they're just not eligible. So I was pretty taken, though, just with the amount of effort they put into it. And, you know, it was a little heartbreaking, of course, that they can't, they're not part of the program. But it's out there. We have an application like that, and it's something to add to the pool of information.
I am inspired that we take this conversation and think more about, can we do something specific for our farmers? So let's continue that conversation and see if we can maybe craft something that's similar to our nonprofit support and the small business support and do that in the farm realm. And to say that, we have $9.5 million, which is slowly getting spent down. So if somebody wants to jump on that proposal, I would suggest doing that sooner rather than later, because the money's going to be spent and then it will be gone. So. All right, so I guess I had the last word then. So unless I hear anything else, I'm going to call for a motion to adjourn. Yes, somebody?
Motion to adjourn.
And a second, please.
I will second it.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you all for a stimulating conversation. Have a great evening.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Thank you.